Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today is Christmas Day. It's December 25th, Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And we begin our broadcast today with Robert Keston. We're going to talk to him about the changes of demeanor, particularly on the Democratic side of the political divide, because we're getting people that are more politically active than ever before. There's a change in demeanor. Many people are going toward a more progressive concepts. And so we're going to first welcome Mr. Keston. Good morning.
Thanks for coming on today
of all days.
Yes.
I'm excited because you ran for Senate. Unfortunately, you lost. I thought you were exceptional and still do. And yet, the beauty of what you're doing is that you're still very much engaged. And what is it about the new demeanor that we see politically that engages you and gives you hope that things will work out toward a better political outcome over time?
Well, I think that in our system, which requires an educated electorate, the more people who are engaged, the more people who are active, the more likely it is that things will get better than worse. And I think that historically that has been proven out. We continue to move from a land that once had slavery to a land where we continue to strive for freedom. We came from a land where women were property of their fathers and then their husbands, and now women lead Fortune 500 companies. And in 2019, we will inaugurate the largest class of women in government, in elective office, ever in the history of this country. So we're making progress literally every day.
Well, bear with me one moment. It looks like we have a call, so maybe that call is for you. Good morning, caller. This is Hezzy. Okay, maybe we'll give you one more shout-out. I guess not. They probably just want to listen to the program, so I'll put them in our silent room so they could listen in. Well, Mr. Keston, there's like a movement that began this particular year more than ever before, or I hadn't been aware of it before, and those are the Indivisibles. And they've been very, very staunch promoters of progressive concepts. What are those concepts and why are they resonating with some and creating consternation from others?
Well, I think that the primary thing is Indivisible literally started shortly after the 2016 elections. So
yeah.
2017 and 2018, they've been very active. And basically it's putting, for many of the groups, it's putting people before politics. And so the policies, whether you want to call them progressive or what have you, are really human-centric. They're what do people need in order to have the kind of lives that we feel that all Americans should be entitled to? And how do we get there? And so I think what makes this movement interesting and exciting is that it's local-based. There is no national dictate. People get to decide for themselves in their own local communities, and some of these individual groups are as small as a town or a village. So people are literally making decisions for themselves, which is very much in line with the idea of the old New England town meetings and many of the other things that fostered democracy in the earliest days of the United States and even pre-USA.
Which almost suggests in a very strong way that we lost that New England type of involvement in society, in our communities. And what was that? Was that whole concept diminished somehow by other political forces, or it needed to be eclipsed somehow in order to bring the nation together in a different way, but it certainly cut out a lot of people's interest in voting and being involved. Do you know what was the cause of that? And even more importantly than what was the cause of that being diminished, is that coming back now?
Well, we certainly see that it's coming back. Will it come back to the level that one would hope, where we have 100% participation? Probably not. But we have to remember that in the early years, only white males were allowed to participate, and in many cases, only white male landowners. So we were talking about a relatively small portion of the overall population was allowed to participate actively in the political process. As that expanded, more and more people fell off. As times were tough, people did what they needed to survive and didn't necessarily participate actively. And then the creation of robust political parties made it so that people felt that they were represented, even if they weren't, by appointed, elected, and interested parties. And so they felt that they had the luxury of not participating the way they once did. I think that people now understand that political parties are, to some extent, private clubs, and they set their own rules. And if you're not part of the inner circle, you're not setting those rules. And if you're not setting those rules, you're not included. So Indivisible isn't party-centric necessarily, and in some places it's almost anti-political party. In other places, it falls in line with some of the mainstream things, but it pushes a more aggressive, people-centric perspective. And as people feel that they are being successful, and the 2018 elections were certainly an example of that, more people are likely to get involved because people like to be part of something that's a success. So the momentum going into the elections of 2019 and then again the elections of 2020 right now look pretty good in terms of participation by citizens, both on the right and the left, because one inspires the other. But I think that most importantly is people are trying to think of what is best for them, what is best for their communities, what is best for their states, and what is best for the nation. And we disagree on a lot of those things, but at least the conversation has begun, and now we have to hope that both sides of the extremes and everybody in the middle will eventually be able to have a conversation with each other rather than simply fight with each other.
Does that look like a strong possibility, or is that really it seems plausible, but we've always seemed to vacillate from one extreme to the other. And we haven't seen a middle ground for a very long time. And why were people exasperated by the political demeanor that we've had, let's say, in the last 20 years, maybe even longer? Because people of color were dismissed. We were incarcerating people for smoking marijuana and that may have been the law then, maybe it was too strong and overwhelming, but what's happened is that we incarcerated so many people that it's turned into a business. Is that often what happens from political extremes create all these laws that actually incarcerate a lot of people who can ill afford to actually fight the system?
Well, I think it's probably more easily understood than that. Government is difficult. Good government is frighteningly difficult. So to make it easier, very often legislators, law enforcement, and others will pass rules and laws and try to hold things in check by making things stricter and more confined. It's easier to pass a law and make something illegal than it is to try and work things out. So what happens over time is government wanting to stay in power and the power elite wanting to stay in power pass restrictive laws, whether they do it in taxes, whether they do it in the drug laws, whether they do it in how to control housing and other land control issues. They pass laws that make it more restrictive. So it's much easier to govern. It's harder to be a citizen. Yeah. but it's much easier to govern. And what we've seen is that we have come to a point where people pass laws on top of laws on top of laws on top of laws, many times even going against what human nature would encourage laws to be. So instead of us having a conversation, instead of us doing the hard work of community building and governing, we pass laws to make it easier for those in charge. And I think what we see now is a rebellion against those imprisonments and an attempt to try and level the playing field once again and saying, you know, you can't keep passing laws that make everything that we do criminal just because it makes it easier for you to be a government. The government is of, by, and for the people, not the other way around. And where we are right now, it's more inclined to favor a government than it is the citizen. And so that pendulum is swinging back the other way, and we're seeing liberalization of certain laws. We're seeing a different understanding of the way that the public responds to corporate influence, and we're trying to work that out. But these things are very difficult, and the best of all things is always difficult, and working through them, whether it's a relationship between spouses, whether it's great art or great music, all of those things take pain and suffering and effort to make them as wonderful and as amazing as they are. And government and community building and all of those things are equal to that. If you want a great community, it takes constant work. If you want a great government, it takes constant work. And when the public is lazy, we get the kind of government we end up deserving, which is one that becomes much more authoritarian, one more concerned with staying in power than actually sharing power and listening. And then you get pushed back the other way when people say enough is enough. And I'm hoping that we'll see the end of the bully in office, not just at the national level, but also at the local levels, where people become executives or legislators and they think that they are the end-all and be-all, and they bully people. And they do that for their own insecurities, and they do that to maintain their own power. And I think that we are now reaching a point where that is less tolerable.
And then, like, for example, when we look at marijuana, we had laws against smoking and all those things, and maybe rightfully so at one time, but I think it became draconian after a while. And why are we changing the rules and regulations? We were admitting medicinal marijuana use, for example. All of a sudden, it seems that states can make a fortune of money by making it legal to smoke marijuana, and that seems to be eclipsing even the lobby of the prisons, and that's a big business as well. So are we driven by money? Is that the thing that is at the end the panacea for everything, and it also informs our conduct with regard to law and creating law?
Absolutely. Money is the great driving force. But I think you've got two things going on at once. You have people who want legalization and or liberalization of those laws because they are unfair and unjust. And then you have, once again, a political elite that are looking at tax dollars. So you have the combination of those two things coming together. What we're not doing, and I think that this is probably the most unfortunate element, is we're not looking at the root causes. So if you look at the root cause of addiction, if you look at the root causes of people feeling the need to escape, if you look at the root causes for the reasons that people use tools to escape, whether it be alcohol or drugs or what have you, then we could do the difficult work of solving those problems. Addiction is a serious illness. We're doing very little in the scheme of things to get to the foundational reasons for that, yet we see the opportunity to bring in huge taxes, we'll go for it. We see the opportunity to liberalize laws so people won't necessarily go to prison or jail or even get a traffic ticket or the equivalent thereof for breaking the law. They're going for that as well. But the one thing that nobody is discussing to the level that it should be on the table is why are we in this position to begin with? And until we have that conversation, we will have this pendulum swing back and forth over and over and over again.
Were we more balanced? You're not old enough to go back 100 years or 50 years from, you know, in, intellectually. Was it different in America 100 years ago or 50 years ago? Or are we just finding out a lot of things about us and America that we didn't know then that we're starting to recognize now? It's not always so pretty either.
No, American history is anything but pretty. It's a very violent culture. It always has been. It's a culture of people moving here from all parts of the world and then having to find their place in society. That's never an easy thing. But that's also what makes this country as amazing as it is that ultimately people do find their place. And when they do, they make a brilliant contribution. But clearly, if you go back 100 years, if you go back even 50 years, we still were towards the – we were in the Jim Crow era. The South had segregation. Women didn't – you know, it's only 100 years since women have had the right to vote. So 150 years ago, there were 160 years ago, there were still slaves. So when you look at it from that respect, and the fact that there are people 100 years old living today, they have seen miraculous changes in this country. Who, born 100 years ago, could have ever grown up imagining an African American president of the United States? You know, so those things are absolutely astounding that we have achieved so much in relatively a short period of time. So the throes of back and forth and people trying to hold on to what they perceive as the glory days of the past is not surprising. But we also don't teach history very well in this country. So therefore, the truth of what happened 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and 150 years ago is not really understood by the vast amount of Americans. So you have a woman elected from Tennessee or Kentucky who says that she would be in the front row of a hanging, which should be an outrage to everybody in her state. We have the problems that we saw in Georgia with racism in the governor's race. We see that all over. That should not be. It just shouldn't be. But yet, people do not really have a grasp of what transpired in this country from its founding to where we are today. And unless we look at history in its totality rather than in elements, we're never going to get there. But more and more people find more and more things unacceptable, and that's partly because we have a continually immigrant integration into our society, and those people bring with them a certain sensibility of justice. And as Jews and then Irish and Latinos and others became more and more a part of the electoral system and got elected to office, they bring that sensibility of being on the outside in. And that helps transform things to a large extent. And that's one reason that we override certain of the worst traits of American history. But it's a painful process. And it allows for exhibitions of hate and anger. And those things have to be worked out.
Well, Mr. Keston, you were always involved politically. And there are many causes that you were a proponent of. What caused you, for example, to become involved in the political world? What allowed you to, I guess, to eclipse the hurdles that other people say, oh, I'm not interested in politics, politics is boring, and yet by not being engaged, you actually cut out your options in life. And yet the disparity of capacity of earning a living causes our least poor or our most poor to to not be able to expend the energy necessary to stay up on top of what's going on politically? And isn't our society dividing even further along those lines? And it's a big disparity between rich and poor. I'm not talking the ultra rich. Just, you know, and our middle class is shrinking. That doesn't bode too well for our coming together on ideas and concepts so that we're no longer influenced by my money or greed one way or the other. So how do we move forward? And yet America seems to have done that before and led the way for all of the world, and now we seem to be stuck with the rest of the world too. So we're not leading and exploring new avenues of growth.
Well, in some respects that's true, and in other respects that's probably not true. But it is certainly true that for much of American history, the United States was always striving to be better. And although we hit many a downturn, you know, you're going from an Abraham Lincoln to an Andrew Johnson, that was a big downturn period. But then we ended up going back up and going back up and going back up and making the progress that we did through FDR and through Johnson's Great Society and then through the Obama 8 years. And now we're in one of those downturns where we are pulling back, where we are leaving our allies in the lurch. But we're going to learn from this also. And like in anything, like in a great relationship, you go through those down periods and you come out stronger in the end. And the motivation that we see in people getting active and the ability to get information, accurate and inaccurate, through the internet is a great equalizer for people of all races, creeds, and colors to get the information that they need going forward. You know, so even though we don't always have a level playing field, and even though we don't have justice and fairness for all, we do have mechanisms as time goes on and as technology improves to get the word out to the poor, to the middle class, and even to the very aloof, very wealthy, who none of this really matters to because they're protected by great wealth. So, So we're moving in we're still moving in a positive direction, but we have to be more vigilant. And with the technology, we have to be more aware because it's, as we've discovered, it's very easy for other people to influence what's going on without our knowledge. And corporations, once again, are designed to make money, and they will take money, whether they're Facebook or Google, from anybody willing to pay until they're caught. So we have to be extra vigilant. We have to be more aware than ever. But at the same time, that awareness gives us the tools in order to make the positive changes that are out there to be made. And in 2019, we're going to be able to think about things that people in 1819 never had the luxury to think about. So where we have spare time because we can go to a supermarket or have washers and dryers, those people had to spend that time making food from scratch. Those people had to wash, you know, by hand. Those things took tremendous amounts of time out of their lives, not giving them the opportunities to think about what would it be like if women were equal? What would it be like if African Americans were a full members of society? You know, those were things that they couldn't even think about. Kids were working back in those days. Why? Because they had to. Children are allowed to be children now, but we shouldn't lose that by pushing them to do more than a child should do, and we should make sure that they're getting the education that they will need in the 21st and 22nd centuries, not allow them to be preoccupied substituting friendships and relationships and family with technology.
And then, so how do we move the equation forward? But one thing that's become very crystal clear is that individuals do make that difference. It doesn't get embodied in some sort of law that moves things forward. And each individual can bring something to the equation, and then with a few individuals, you can really move something ahead. Well, why don't we make the investment, for example, in education, rather than allowing it to wallow where it does today, where even the education system is failing? We're not investing enough money in that. Our relationship with business, between education and business, at one time it was strong. Business told the schools what they needed, and they taught toward that end. Now we don't seem to be doing that either. So where do the ethics come from?
Well, you have to also look at the fact that everything moves very, very quickly these days. So whereas in the 90s and the 80s and before, things moved faster than they did in the generations before that, but still at a human pace. And now nothing moves at a human pace. We move at a technological pace. We're not adjusting to it as of yet, and it will take time. Humans are animals, and our evolutionary cycle isn't like that of a virus. It takes time, and we're learning as we go. And that's a painful process. I mean, I keep mentioning, you know, all of these things are difficult. Nothing is easy. Yeah. And our level of frustration sometimes grows out of proportion to the reality of what we can do and what we can't do. The best way of dealing with all of this is educating yourself and using the systems that we have in place to educate us. The more we know, the better we know it. The more we know about how to find information and how to process that information, the better off we'll be. Education, after all, is without question the great equalizer. People who are better educated are healthier. People who are better educated live better lives, are able to communicate, are able to work through problems. And I don't think our schools are failing at all. I think that the problem is that we're no longer as respectful of teachers and educators as we need to be. And communities need to work with the professionals in the schools and in the colleges and make that relationship stronger rather than weaker. I mean, I know that I substitute periodically in the Bedford Public Schools, primarily in the high school. And I know that teachers and administrators are often intimidated by the aggressiveness of parents who are willing to deny everything in order to say that their child is the best, the brightest, the nicest, the most decent, even when their child is problematic in school. And they're problematic in school probably because there's problems at home. And the parent is not doing their child any help at all and is not allowing the school to carry out its mandate of educating the population as a whole. So education in the proper way, lifelong learning, is essential. When we finish school, when we're in the workforce, that should not stop us from reading, from writing, from experimenting, exploring. Because those are the things that keep us alive and active, and those are the things that save our society from becoming stuck in the past. And no matter what happens, no matter how much you like the moment that you're in, the one thing that will always happen is change. And that's why when you hear the Trump theory of make America great again signifies a going back. You can never go back, ever. And going back, if you really understand history, is not such a good thing. So we have to find the way to go. So we have to find the way to go forward. We have to find the way to build on our successes and learn from our failures. And I think that 2019 should be very good for that. I'm hopeful. I'm going to keep pushing for it myself. I'm going to rely on the knowledge I have of things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Declaration of Independence and use them as motivational forces. Anybody who's out there that wants something interesting to read, there's a book called Ratification by author Pauline Maier, M-A-I-E-R, that talks about how the Constitution was approved, and what George Washington, who chaired that committee, thought of it. It's a really amazing book that gives you insight into this country and how we are who we are. So there are many things out there that are well worth the time and effort and give us a perspective of where we've come from and where we're going.
I did agree with everything that you said, and maybe I didn't explain myself well enough. In the schools, I also find an intrusion by people in control, so that quite often the superintendents are burdened by following a particular direction of government and governance, and the teachers are losing out on that too. That used to not be that way, and there was a greater balance.
And I agree, and that goes back to what we were discussing. Right, and that goes back to what we were discussing before. It becomes easier for government if they can control, and it becomes harder to do the right thing when we allow government that right. So, yes, you're absolutely right. We put mandates on teachers and superintendents and principals that don't necessarily lead to their doing the best job possible for the students or their communities, because that's tougher. And government wants to interfere because it makes it easier for government.
Well, Mr. Keston, unfortunately, this half hour went so quickly, but what an exciting way to spend a Christmas day. And I want to thank you for coming online as well. I'm glad that we're going to be able to do this also into the future. All the best to you and a Happy New Year as well.
A Happy New Year to you and anyone who's listening. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right.
Well, there we go. Robert Keston, political activist for sure. And the best part of all is that he's maintaining the spirit and of his election effort to become a New York State Senator in the 40th District alive by staying aware and concerned. I see that Delpha Musler is on the line. So I'm so excited. Delpha Musler, happy Christmas Day.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays to you, to you and your listeners. It's always a pleasure to be on your radio show.
Well, thank you, and I'm also thrilled that you came up with a great subject that I want to discuss with you as well. And I have to admit, though, I'm also quite ignorant of the Yonkers Inspector General Brendan McGrath's findings with respect to the Yonkers Housing Building Inspector's conduct. I'd heard that there was a notice of it on the city website, the yonkersny.gov, and I looked for it, but I couldn't find it. Maybe it's no longer there. And I tried to also look it up through the search engine at the government office, government website, but I couldn't find it. So maybe you can inform us a little bit more about it. What transpired? What did the Inspector General find?
That's, I think one or two of the building inspectors had took like bribed to let things, you know, building that they were doing and the building they were doing inspections on, and then basically they took the bribe, you know, to the landlord would tell them to would give them the money and to make sure that things don't get reported, which is weird. Conduct, and it really that's one of the reasons why we had an Inspector General's office and everything to look into things like this, and hopefully it goes a lot further than that, because that kind of conduct is definitely not what should be happening in our housing and building department.
Absolutely not. I've known that's been going on for a long time personally, but I just never knew how that was going to get caught, because there was so much fear of retribution, and the housing inspectors were very, very powerful. They could issue a summons for not doing something, even if it was legitimately okay. But they could literally threaten people, and they did. And that's the other question, too. I don't know about you, but I haven't seen very much writing from the Inspector General in the first 10 years of his time.
Actually, I think it's been a long since you've done the report. Yeah, no, it's true. I agree with you. Actually, you know, also another issue too, which is interesting, is I think, like you talked about, that people are afraid to report stuff, like be whistleblowers, because they're afraid of retribution, afraid of getting diminished and minimized by City Hall. And, you know, it's that's why we should have that day where people are able and feel free to be able to bring stuff out, because, like I said, it's the whistleblowers that really bring reform.
Absolutely, and I even must admit, even in writing the Yonkers Tribune, and I'm sure it was you writing the Yonkers Insider, that you give the freedom, you give expression to the freedom that you have by your own sense of worth and your own purpose that quite often other people don't have. And because they are concerned about losing their job, or they are concerned that their children won't get a job because everybody does want to work in Yonkers. What's the point of traveling to New York City unless you've got a specific job that you want to do that can only be done there? And everybody is basically employed by the city of Yonkers in government or at the Board of Education. I think there are over 5,000 people that work there. That's compelling. Very compelling.
Absolutely. And there always seems to be an issue, you know, when people know stuff and they just want to stay quiet, I guess because they just don't want to feel because if you bring out stuff and then the people from City Hall, they get all, you know, bent out of shape, and they put that person on the outsiders list and everything.
Right, very true. As a corollary also to this finding, this report, which is very important, I didn't read it as I told you, but whatever was found by the Inspector General, I think that's usually the first part of a multi-level parts that
need to be put into
place, like you had intimated that before. So instead of forgetting it by just telling it, what do you think government can do? And whose responsibility will that be? Will it be the Inspector General? Will it be the department head of housing? Who's going to be responsible to put into force some sort of conduct? And why don't we look into these issues much more quickly? Because I've been doing it for maybe 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. No, it's true. And like I say, maybe, because usually what happens in a circumstance like this, usually sometimes they send a report to, like, the district attorney's office, something just to look into it, because, I don't know, it's definitely a conduct that really shouldn't be happening in our city and really is you know, not eye-opening, because you've been hearing about it for 10 to 15 years. I've been hearing about it for about 10 to 15 years. It really is. But like I say, that kind of stuff has to be, you know, cleaned up and everything, because we can't – Yonkers needs to have a good reputation, and things like this don't give us a good reputation.
That's very true as well. You know, at the end, though, I don't know if government can do – that much. It seems that individuals can be the most powerful instigator of change for the better. So that if somebody does find that they're assaulted by a building inspector because they're doing things that are illegal and are not supposed to be part of the thing, do you find that people are more open now to reach out to you, Delphin Usler, at the Yonkers Insider?
I think
than
so.
Ever
as
before?
I've gone throughout the years, I think it's gotten better.
Yeah.
Actually, people reaching out. I think when I first started my blog and everything, a lot of people were afraid to get involved. But I think we've seen in the last maybe 5 or 10 years, people more galvanized, and also people would reach out to you as well as part of the Yonkers Tribune. So, you know, we've actually seen in the last 10 or 15 years, things changed. When we first started, I don't think people reach out as much, but I think more when like I said, when you do this for a long time and have great credibility, you basically are able to, people say, oh, I should go and talk to these people because they have credibility and where they can bring action to my concerns. And I think it's gotten better throughout the years, has it?
I think you're right. I tend to believe as well. But, you know, like, you know, people, I was talking to Mr. Keston before. He says, like, we're not like a virus. We don't change very, very quickly. You know, like a virus might live only a day and then the offspring live another day and it goes on and on and on like that. We could live easily to our 50s and 60s and 70s, even 100. And it takes us a long time to actually change and recognize how to change our behavior pattern.
Absolutely.
One thing in media I've noticed is that people were afraid even to reach out to media. They thought that if they spoke man to man with, or man to woman, or woman to women in government, that they would get a response. But quite often, government didn't move there. So, and then the newspapers from years and years ago, maybe they were more responsive than they are today, because
they created us,
didn't they?
Yes, no, absolutely.
The bloggers.
Absolutely. That's how we thrive, because these the media outlets, they don't really do a good job of reporting. That's why it gives a vehicle to the blog to have the bloggers to open the door for the bloggers, because people really want news and everything, and it seems the mainstream media, at least in this city, which there isn't much, they just falling down and dropping. That's why it gave opening to you and me, and to be able to do our blog, because it was a vacuum that we have essentially have a opened up had the opening that was there, which the mainstream media in this city could have used. But what happened was it gave us a chance to go in and open the door, and it was a wide open door, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it's become very forceful in the city with the Yonkers Insider and to an extent as well to us. The bottom line is it's made a big difference in the city. People are more aware. They don't tolerate as much abuse as they used to. And quite often, if they reach out to you or they reach out to me, we can present it in a way that the powers that really are, you know, in government, the ones that we elected to office, can be more responsive, because you know, they recognize that this is bigger than that one-to-one situation. I've always learned that if you and I talk and we didn't talk on radio, nobody would be hearing us. So it's a private conversation. You could say one thing, I could say something else, and there's disagreement and nothing gets done. But if you write it up in the Yonkers Insider, or if I write it up, then we learned it from other people. We were able to corroborate their issues. And then when it's printed in the virtual print mechanism of the blogs, the bottom line is I think it's more powerful than that one-to-one discussion.
I agree. Absolutely. This has evolved throughout the years too. Like I said, it gave us, we had a good opening. It really has evolved, and the blogs have really been the news source in this town for the last, the last 5 or 10 to 12 years. It really has. I remember when I started. It really has gone way beyond what I thought it would go. It really, like I said, we were going through the door where there was a vacuum, because the residents of Yonkers want to have information. They want to know what's really going on. And like I said, the mainstream media, a lot of levels in the city, doesn't report on everything that's going on, and wants to keep stuff because they want to curry favor with City Hall.
Yeah, that's very true. That's the real problem. I'm surprised, really, but I guess I shouldn't be, because when we look at the world and we look at what goes on in Wall Street and big business in the United States, there's so much that really is underhanded. It's not legal. It's not, it doesn't abide by laws and structures.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even ethical. And yet it's permitted to exist because people are making money. And I wonder if we can ever get to a time, not in the past, but at least a future, where we become a little bit more ethical. And I don't know what that's going to take.
That's also very true. You know, hopefully we get to a day where we can have ethics returning back, because unfortunately, I think ethics have gone down a step in the last little while.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you know, the nice thing about Christmas is that it does make us contemplate a little bit more.
That's true.
About where things were, and it certainly Christmas comes at a perfect time. I think whoever planned it certainly planned
absolutely.
It well. Because it comes after a year of really tough work and all kinds of issues and problems and concerns of health and well-being and finances. So it comes at the end of the year, and it works perfectly because we need that respite. And then a little bit of icing on the cake.
The problem this year, which we have for many years now, is the fact that, you know, there seems to be a vitriol. There seems to be, you know, the two sides not coming together. And there's the discourse has really, really gone back. I remember years ago, it used to be the political discourse. There used to be political discourse. Now you can't, because it's yelling back and forth. That's the only thing that's going on, like what's going on in Washington now with the government shutdown, of people yelling on the right, people yelling on the left, and there's no real medium, you know, in terms of having a discussion how we can make our country better, how we can make our county better, how we can make our city better. It seems to be a vitriol from both sides. If someone brings something, an issue up as to make things better, then that person gets attacked. And to me, I think we should all come together. It's always a good New Year's resolution to have, and it never seems to happen, unfortunately.
It doesn't last very long, unfortunately, all these New Year resolutions. After we mention it quite often, it's forgotten. Even if it's remembered 2 or 3 days later, that's about the end of it. So interesting, and you bring up an exceptionally good point, and that is that we have people at one end or another, and maybe even a third or fourth or a fifth, and
that's
we're
true.
All yelling at each other, and we don't have a discussion. And that evidently there's a tremendous amount of fear of talking.
I agree.
I don't know. What do people think? They're going to take out a gun and blow your brains out? I mean, like, it's just a discussion.
Yeah, no, it gets very ridiculous and everything. It really does. Because, like I say, in the past, you know, people are able to talk and bring up issues, concepts that could maybe make our way of life better and everything. People, I think, today are afraid to bring up concepts like that because they're gonna get demonized by the other side and everything. And I just say to myself, well, person's trying to bring up a concept that's going to make things better, then there's no reason for the other side to be blown the vitriol back that they do. And it seems to only get worse and worse every year. And the question always is when are we going to go back to the political discourse that we used to have, in terms of, you know, we disagree on issues, but at least we can respect each other. Right now, there's no respect, and there's no respect or anything. It seems like a lot of these politicians and community leaders don't want to even bring up anything because they're afraid that the other side's going to rip them apart on Facebook and Twitter. And I think social media has played a role in this as well. And I just think it just gets worse and worse. Honestly,
it does. There are a lot. Social media is really, I think, hurt in many respects, because it's not a political forum. It's just a screaming match quite often, and nobody pays attention to it. It's just a drama. Oh. It's like going to, instead of watching a baseball game, you're watching a fight. A verbal fight back and forth. Oh, it just doesn't quit. It's like watching one of those TV shows, you know, where everyone is failing and nobody knows what to do. So they have a screening match. And
yes.
So it doesn't work out. Well, one thing's for sure. In the past, not everybody was included in the conversation.
Absolutely.
And hopefully
yeah.
in the future, more people will be involved in the conversation.
Absolutely.
And there's
yeah.
a lot of anger when people don't respect who you are.
Yes.
And I don't know why we don't know how to respect each other well.
I think as a society, we've actually lost that. Because like I say, you're
yeah.
either on this side or on that side. But I'm saying to myself, there should be a third side of I'm for what's making life better and everything. And unfortunately, the two sides are just going at each other like it's a steel cage match or something. And it's supposed to be the way to help our government to make our lives better, whether it's the city, the county, state, or nationally, and stuff like that. And it seems there's no change in sight. I hopefully
right.
it'll change real soon, because it really is the going back and forth between both sides really is not going to get us anything other than like you say, drama.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the political level,
mm-hmm.
I've also found that a lot of the politicians that either represent us or represent other communities, they always tell us that they're going to work on something, but they don't keep us involved and engaged in what they're really doing in the whole
yeah.
thing by just telling us, well, we're going to straighten out the schools, or we're going to straighten out the red light districts, or we're going to, meaning the, you know, where you get caught in the red light or passing it in driving, or we're going to do something about alleviating a tax or something like that. And they just say they want it to be better. But what's interesting is it doesn't get better because they don't really work at it. And I don't understand why
sure.
they're failing.
And also another thing too, Hazy, which we've talked about, is they don't really inform the public as to, they say we're going to do this and we're going to do
sure.
that, but they never really inform, is this happening or has that happened? Never. It seems like there's never an update. It seems like they just give their little buzzwords and
sure.
the little rhetoric words, and then basically they just you don't hear from them again until the next election. And even some of the people
right.
run for lose, you never hear from them. That's why I was so inspirational for your last guest, that he's staying involved in everything.
I was thrilled about that as well. But, before we talk about him for a moment, let's find out. There's a caller on the line. Maybe they want to
okay.
call you. So let's just see what's going on. Good morning, caller. Thanks for waiting. Delphine and I are on the line. Do you have a question or a statement?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Chris. I'm from East Central Illinois, and I was just going to point out that the things that we view as controlling, like the domineering social class, that's a hierarchy of just a bunch of rich people
uh-huh.
running everything, they tell us all the time that they are in control, so we can't really blame them. They tell us everything that they're doing all the time. I mean, I introduced my friend, who was a full-on conspiracy theorist. I introduced him into the LLC environment the other day. And he was like, oh, my God, it's on this website that it's just an entity. I was like, yeah, they tell you that. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation, is that nobody is doing anything to control anyone.
Point. It's a great point.
Yeah,
they tell us
what they're doing.
If it works. If it works for the people who are very well off and in powerful positions, then maybe we're failing ourselves if we're not in the same financial and powerful position they're in. But maybe we need to do something about expressing our ideas of what's pertinent and how to conduct ourselves and why we're on the same level. Maybe it doesn't look that way, but you and I and Delphine, for example, we're all equals. There doesn't make a change, and maybe you're very wealthy, and I'm certainly not, and hopefully Delphine is getting wealthier as we speak. So it's maybe that's what we need to do.
Yeah,
I was just pointing out. That everything that the people that we are deeming to be the controllers, they tell us what to do. They tell us what they're doing all the time. So I think it would be really wise for people to understand how the wealthy stay wealthy and how the poor stay poor, so that we don't
Good
have
point.
To have this divide,
yeah.
you know.
Very true. Well, I want to thank you for giving us a call. It's what a pleasure. So you have anything else, any closing statements, or are we good?
Oh,
I would
we're good.
Wish
no,
you a Merry Christmas.
I'll just, Merry Christmas to you too, sir. No, I'll mute out. I just want to listen to the show now.
No problem. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to put him into our silent room so he could listen in. And do you think that's what – I think that guy's got some really some valid points. I mean, maybe we –
I agree.
We're not doing
oh,
a good
absolutely.
Job.
Yes, and that's
yeah.
true. Absolutely. It does show
yeah,
that, you know, like
– start saying it.
Yes, no, absolutely. And,
sorry,
Jocelyn,
go ahead.
It is a pertinent thing also has, you know, the fact that he – well, he says it is right that, you know – the people stay rich, the rich stay rich and the poor get poorer. The question, how do you change the concept where the poor get a little get a little more money in their pockets and, you know, get at least a little better? You know, it's that seems to be the problem, that, you know, the hierarchy seems to want to keep the people down, and the ones who are the insiders,
yeah.
they keep up. You know, it's sad. But like I said, we got to do more to be able to get people's stories out there. I think that's a job that we always have on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And it's just very sad because sometimes a lot of my readers, they get a little down because they say nothing's really ever changing. Everything's staying the same. I said, well, you gotta get involved and you gotta be galvanized and you gotta make your views out there and make your views heard. It's always important that like the thing that helps with our blogs is we encourage our readers to have their views heard and everything.
Exactly. Really good point. I don't know if you saw this or not. I know that I was just aware of it because it passed through. And it relates to what this guy was saying, I think, to some extent. There,
mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of these TED Talks? They're usually a video that you could find on YouTube. And
yes.
people who are quite specialists in particular fields, they talk about it. Even simple people like me who might want to talk about a particular issue or discipline. So it turns out, I guess through scientific awareness, they believe that mothers can actually nurture their children to be more to raise them in a way that they feel emboldened too. They were talking particularly about the divide between men and women and why
uh-huh.
women don't seem to gravitate towards positions of power as much as men do. And maybe that's part of the chemical makeup that differentiates men from women. But at the same time, it might be there might be a way of nurturing children so that they feel stronger about themselves, have a better self-image of themselves, and
oh,
also
huh.
would consider, you know, gravitating to some more powerful positions over time because we may just not know how to raise children. You know? I just don't know,
yeah.
man. And I don't blame that on women. Maybe there could be a tremendous amount of importance that men can bring to the equation as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
with their wives. And so I've got to listen to that. It should be very fascinating and probably something
oh,
that I
okay.
could learn from. I think I'm a little bit too old to have any children at this age, though, Delphin, but you're young enough maybe to do that. You know, I'm 69. I don't think I'm having any more children. So, but I guess it's good to know.
Yes, no, absolutely, no, absolutely. All those kinds of videos are always helpful, you know, on a lot of levels.
Yeah, absolutely. So, are you planning to do anything special for Christmas Day, or are you
just making my Christmas dinner for my dad and everything? A couple friends coming over,
good for
so
you.
Great. I always try and keep keep my mom's holiday traditions. I try to do that to the greatest of my ability this year because she had a lot of great holiday traditions, and I'm proud that I kept my focus and I kept those holiday traditions going.
Well, that's great. So did she teach you, or were you just enthralled, just talking with her as she was cooking and you picked up all the recipes?
Actually, I was able to, actually, in the last couple of years when she was sick, she was in the kitchen, and she would have me do the cooking because she said, one day I'm not going to be here, so I want to show you how to do the cooking. And really was good. And I'm actually turned into a very good cook the last several years.
That is fantastic. So are there special traditional dishes that she cooked and that you're now cooking for Christmas?
Yes, I make a lot of stuff that she used to make. I always try and follow her example when it comes to making the food. I always make a lot of stuff, so we have a lot of leftovers after the holiday. But I always try to keep the traditions together as much as humanly possible. And like I said, I miss her, but I know that she's with me, and I'll always keep the holiday traditions going and keep the holiday traditions alive. Sometimes it's tough on a holiday because it's always tough sometimes because sometimes things are not good. But like I said, you always have to have a smile on your face. That was one of the things that my mom always taught me.
Well, yeah, I met her a few times, and she always brought a sense of joy about her. There was something very, very positive about her. And you could feel
she
it.
Had great
you
feel.
Could feel it. She didn't have to say anything. You just felt
That's
it.
That's true. You know, in fact, the nurse who always took her to dialysis always said to me, one thing she always remembered about her, and she misses that she always had a smile on her face, even when the day at dialysis didn't go good, she always had that smile on her face.
Yeah, that's absolutely wonderful. It just shows the strength that she had. And I'm
absolutely.
Sure she just didn't want to go. You know, sometimes you could will that.
Absolutely.
No, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Well, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and also a Happy New Year. And
Thank you.
I think we're probably on next week. I don't know what day that is.
Great.
But I don't know if it's before New Year's or after. But
actually, I'll be New Year's Day.
Oh, well, that's great. So
yes.
I could celebrate that too. Well, you know,
okay, great.
I want to thank you very much for making the time for the program. I really enjoy talking to you, and I've learned a great deal.
And I really enjoy being on your show, be able to talk about the issues with you that matter, and be able to talk for half an hour with you, and be able to let the citizens of Yonkers know what our thoughts are, and make the conclusions.
Absolutely. What a pleasure. Well, thank you very much, Delphim, and I'll speak to you on New Year's Day.
And we'll talk to you next Tuesday. Thank you so much on New Year's Day. Thank you.
My pleasure. All the best. And good appetite, too.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Hezzy. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than Delphim Usler. He's the publisher and the editor of Yonkers Insider. And you could just look up Yonkers Insider through any search engine. I usually use Google. So Yonkers Insider, and you'll be able to link right through there. And I think you'll enjoy it. Well, let me just quickly look about one thing. I mean, here it is, Christmas. But evidently, Christians are at risk of being literally decimated. Their populations decimated in the land where Christmas began. And this is very, very compelling. We've talked about it on this show for many, many years, and yet I don't see enough effort to save Christendom in the Middle East. I don't know what the answers are, but it's outrageous. People are getting killed left and right because they're Christian. Anyway, as Christians around the world celebrate the nativity of their Savior, we gather in churches and hear the story of the Middle East where the Holy Family, as religious minorities in the Roman Empire, witnessed the birth of Christ far from their hometown. And we will recall that they then fled to Egypt as political refugees. 2,000 years later, the Christian communities of the Middle East, descendants of the first Christians, persevere in their faith in Christ, and they live in an era of violence, unrest, and persecution, and many have been forced to flee their homes and many more their countries. Tabari, that's from England, Justin Welby, recently wrote of the plight of Christians in the Middle East, stating, quote, many have left, hundreds of thousands have been forced from their homes, end quote. He warned that, quote, across the region, Christian communities that were the foundation of the universal church now face the threat of imminent extinction. I am sorry to say the Archbishop is not overstating the dire nature of the plight faced by Christian communities throughout the region. Lebanon, the last safe home to Christians in the Middle East, has generously welcomed a great number of Syrians fleeing their country's civil war. A nation of 4 million people is hosting an estimated 2 million refugees and displaced people, the highest per capita home to refugees in the world. This population increase has presented legitimate challenges to Lebanon's infrastructure, economy, and education system. After 7 years of conflict in Syria with no end in sight, more children are born in Lebanon to displaced people and refugees than to Lebanese citizens. Lebanon's delicate, pluralistic balance of power between faith groups could be toppled in a complete redrawing of the demographic map, and the lack of a roadmap for charting the safe return of refugees and displaced people to Syria is not providing a viable future for these victims. In northern Iraq's former breadbasket, the Nineveh Plains, the ancient Christian and Yazidi communities are slowly returning and rebuilding their homes, but they are a skeleton of what they once were. The Christian population of Iraq has dropped from 1.5 million people before 2003 to less than 250,000 today. And those who remain are in a struggle. And heritage alive in a place where their families have celebrated Christmas since the time of Christ. In Egypt, the Coptic Church was again the target of terrorist violence in recent months. In 2017 alone, 128 Coptic Christians were killed because of their faith in Christianity. Churches have been bombed, pilgrims have been targeted, and Christian homes have been vandalized. Attacks on the Coptic community have been horrific, and they are tragically leaving Egypt in record numbers. They actually make up about 10% of the population of Egypt. The majority, 90%, are Muslim. Another year is passing in which the United States has not recognized the Armenian genocide, and they are Christian. And Turkey continues to harass churches and unjustly imprison innocent people. Yet Christmas is a time of anticipation, new birth, and hope. So while we hold the suffering of religious minorities in the Middle East in our hearts, let us reflect on the good that has been done in 2018 to bring a much-needed ray of hope and expectation for the coming year. So in Iraq, the promise of Vice President Mike Pence that help is on the way resulted in U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, committing more than $300 million in aid for religious minorities. U.S. Aid Administrator Mark Green went personally to the region to conduct a needs assessment and appointed a special representative, Max Primorac, to directly oversee the implementation of U.S.-funded programs. Administrator Green deserves credit for managing the difficult deliverance of aid in a complex sectarian environment. Just two weeks ago, President Trump made history by signing the Iraq and Syria Genocide Relief and Accountability Act, partisan and precedent-setting law, sponsored by Representatives Chris Smith, Republican of New Jersey, and Anna Eshoo, Democrat of California, that will for the first time allow religious minorities, who are the most vulnerable victims of ISIS, to be given direct aid by the U.S. government. Another precedent was set when the Trump administration sanctioned Turkey, a NATO ally, until it released American pastor Andrew Brunson. And this direct use of American influence to free an innocent man should be a model for future foreign policy in Egypt. Continuous congressional pressure has led President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to take some important steps toward justice and security for Copts, which included include prosecuting terrorists who have targeted them, rebuilding destroyed churches, and appointing the first Coptic female governor of an Egyptian province. Egypt also recently launched a program to restore its Jewish religious sites. Given that Egypt is the recipient of $1.6 billion in U.S. aid, we should make clear that future support is dependent upon its improvement of human rights. In Lebanon, America continues to support the Lebanese Armed Forces, the nation's legitimate security force, and constantly denounce Iranian and other outside interference that threatens Lebanon with instability and conflict. While much has been accomplished, much more work continues and remains to be done before Christians can celebrate Christmas without fear in the place where it all began 2 millennia ago. From a Middle Eastern Christian writing from the lands where Jesus walked, Merry Christmas. And we're speaking about Tufik Baklini. He's a Lebanese-American with more than 30 years of business experience in finance, and Baklini is the president and chairman of the board of directors of In Defense of Christians and has committed years of service to preserving the historic Christian communities of the Middle East. Well, thank you for that. He wrote this in The Hill, and it's absolutely compelling. So we're going to close right now and wish you a great day, a Merry Christmas, and we hope you'll join us again. Let me just see who's on tomorrow. I don't remember who's on tomorrow. Oh, I can't believe it. We're going to have Nader Sayez. She's the new assemblyman who represents Assembly District 90. We're going to hear from him. He's already been sworn in before a lot of others who will not be sworn in until January 1, but because the position of assemblyman to the 90th Senate Assembly District was empty, once he got elected, he was sworn in, and he's already serving as our assemblyman. What a thrill. We're going to talk to him and find out what's important in his mind and how he intends to move forward as the assemblyman and what the issues are that are driving him to do the work well. He's got 2 years ahead of him, and I have great hopes for him because he's such a knowledgeable man. Anyway, so tomorrow, 10 o'clock, Nader Sayez, assemblyman, 90th Assembly District. So that's it, folks. Thanks again for being with us today. What a pleasure. And I just want to go back to our studio screen and wish you a goodbye. And goodbye.